This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, Rich Gelfond, the CEO of IMAX, joins us to talk about why he's helping to raise awareness about mercury poisoning. We'll also get some tips from Avital Binstock at Sierra Magazine for unusual green holiday gifts. And we'll talk with Chris Payne, the filmmaker of Revenge of the Electric Car. Joining us now is Rich Gelfond, the CEO of IMAX. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
We were thrilled that you were able to talk with us today on the show. We wanted to invite you to come on the show when we read the article in the new issue of Sierra Magazine that talks about the risks of mercury poisoning. And I was surprised to see that the article starts out talking with you about how you discovered that you had been exposed to toxic mercury. And I'm wondering, what was that process like for you? How did you figure out that mercury was affecting you?
It actually was a very difficult process because I think so little is known about mercury as a toxin. So I started with kind of minor symptoms, like I used to run a lot and I had a little bit difficulty running. I had some balance issues where I just didn't feel great walking. And it got progressively worse to a point where eventually I had trouble even walking, slight tremors. And I dismissed it a little bit early on. It was a very stressful period of my life. And, you know, I thought it was maybe stress-related. But it kept getting worse and worse to a point where I went to my general practitioner and I said, you know, what's going on here? Long story short, he referred me to a neurologist, and the neurologist said to me, oh, my God, you better get an MRI right away. I think you may have a brain tumor.
Wow.
And, you know, needless to say, I didn't have a great night's sleep before I had the MRI the next morning. And the MRI and all the other tests came back that everything was normal. And I kept going to the neurologist, and I kept getting more tests, and the tests came back that everything was normal. And meanwhile, my condition kept deteriorating and getting worse and worse. Then one day I went to see him. I'm seeing him at this point for around 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into his office, and he says to me, do you, by any chance, eat a lot of fish? And I thought to myself, boy, that's a strange question. But I said to him, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. I eat really healthy. As a matter of fact, I probably eat 2 out of every 3 meals or fish meals a week. And he said, what kind of fish do you eat? And I said, tuna, salmon, swordfish, you know, all kinds of fish, a wide variety. And he said to me, would you do me a favor and go to the lab and get a test for mercury poisoning? So I went to the lab, and it came back that my results were 76. I think it's parts per million, but I don't remember exactly what it translates into. And I got a call from New York State Department of Environment telling me that that was the third highest level ever recorded in the history of New York State.
Oh, my gosh.
And they asked me if I worked at a chemical plant or, you know, I worked around mercury substances, which I don't. And it turns out that the level that's considered high is 10. And numbers like where I was were, you know, highly unusual, and people were typically very sick. So the doctor said, you know, he thinks it's possible that I had mercury poisoning. So I called a number of hospitals and doctors in the New York area, and I was told almost unanimously that mercury doesn't affect adults in a toxic way. It's more a problem for pregnant mothers, and, you know, that can't be it, and, you know, go back to the drawing board. Meanwhile, my neurologist said to me he thought there was a high likelihood. He didn't know a lot about it, but he looked it up in some of his medical books, and he said, stop eating all fish. And I did, and it turns out that the half-life of mercury is about 90 days. So, as you would expect, I went to about 35 in 90 days, and I went to 18 in 180 days, and, you know, it kept on this downward trajectory.
And did you find that you started feeling better?
No, that's what I was going to say. I wasn't feeling better. And I went to see different different kinds of doctors. So I developed neuropathy. As a matter of fact, I was feeling worse. And I went to a doctor and had all kinds of tests done and all sorts of things looked at. And they couldn't, again, account for, what it was. And at a time of sort of maximum frustration, the symptoms really started to subside in a very material way.
Mm-hmm.
So 6 months after I stopped eating the fish, my balance started to be better. I could, walk most of the time without feeling like I was going to fall over. And probably within 9 months or a year, I could resume playing tennis, which is something I really like to do. It never got completely better. I would say it's probably about 70% recovered. More recently, I find that different exercises, particularly Pilates, really helps flexibility and regain muscle strength.
Mm-hmm.
So I keep working at it, but nerves are very slow to heal. So we'll see where it goes, but I'm far from what I was before this odyssey started.
And so this is a very personal journey. What made you decide to speak out about this issue and share your story?
Well, I was kind of really distraught by not only the amount of time it took for the diagnosis, but the fact that I was unaware of the dangers, and the fact that after I was diagnosed, virtually no one knew what to do about it, how to treat it. So I set up an endowment at Stony Brook University, where I happen to be chairman of the board and where they also happen to have an interdisciplinary environmental center that brings together the medical school and different of the science laboratories and the hospital and all kinds of places. And I developed this effort to increase awareness to the public, increase awareness to the medical profession, do some primary research to attract more research dollars in and really get publicity for the effort. So since in my day job, I'm CEO of IMAX Corporation, the entertainment company, I tend to have access to various media channels. So I felt that in addition to my financial commitment, by speaking out, I could attract some attention, hopefully, which helps other people avoid this problem and also eventually leads to dollars committed to research.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that's interesting is that people who have heard of mercury, often think, oh, that means, I shouldn't eat fish because that's where we get exposed to mercury. But another interesting part of the story is that the mercury gets into the fish because it comes from coal-burning power plants in the first place. And, we've heard that the Obama administration is considering what would be the first ever national protections that would reduce the mercury pollution from these power plants. I'm wondering if, anywhere along this journey, did anyone ever explain to you, how the mercury gets in the fish and the fact that we can actually clean it up so that fish are safe to eat for the future?
Well, since I'm intellectually curious, that was one of the first things I learned after getting the diagnosis. And in fact, a number of countries have done various things. Canada has made enormous progress in terms of mercury levels being emitted into the air. It's actually quite complex, the science and the interaction. And, sort of the short version is that the mercury, which is inorganic, becomes organic when different bacteria in the water interact with it, and then it goes into the plants, and the fish eat the plants, and that's how it gets into the ecosystem. And the big fish are at the top of the ecosystem, and that's why they tend to have the highest levels of mercury. So there are actually a number of sources. There is some natural mercury just in the earth. You're correct, coal-burning power plants are a very large source of it. Discharge from different kinds of waste sites are a source of it. But I think, one thing we do have to look at is what can we do as human beings mm-hmm. to control those levels.
Throughout this process, did it inspire you or did it depress you? I mean, what has it left you with?
Well, one of my friends said to me, a very good friend, he said, Rich, people talk about the environment like it's some abstract issue, but here it is manifesting itself in your body and, creating a situation where you can't walk, and that's today. So it definitely increased, my awareness of the role of the environment today and the importance of the environment. I mean, I'd always been interested in different ways. I once was involved with a business that dealt with auto emission control. Obviously, IMAX makes a lot of movies that have different environmental messages in them. But, you know, certainly this created a greater interest because the reality was looking at me in the mirror.
You know, you mentioned IMAX and environmental films. While we have you on the line, I'd love to hear from you any thoughts you have about any upcoming environmental themes we should look out for in your films.
Well, we have a film coming out in April called To the Arctic, and it's really about the Arctic region, and because of global warming, the way the ice packs are melting, and animals like polar bears really are much more subject to either drowning, and the cubs prey because they can't use their traditional ways of survival. So it has a fairly strong message kind of wrapped around a very interesting story of the polar bear species.
Anything else that you want to add for our listeners?
The only thing is perhaps that, you know, sometimes things you think you're doing that are good for your body, which is what I thought I was doing by eating fish, you really need to revisit. So I think particularly in the area of what you're putting in your body, you probably should get more information before you do it to make sure that what you're doing is really healthy and not hurting yourself.
That's a great segue. I should add that for our listeners who want to find out what kinds of fish are safe to eat, if you go to sierraclub.org/mercury, you can download a pocket guide that tells you which fish are high in mercury. And the Sierra Club will soon be launching our very first iPhone app that is all about safe sushi. And we will share more information about that on the show once it's ready. But you can keep yourself posted at sierraclub.org/mercury.
Well, I'll check it out myself.
Rich, thank you so much for joining us today. It's really been an honor to have you on the show, and we're glad to hear that your health is getting better. And we hope you'll join us again soon to talk about other IMAX shows that are coming out that talk about environmental issues.
It's my pleasure. I'd be happy to talk to you again.
Well, thanks so much for being on our show today. You've been listening to Rich Gelfond, the CEO of IMAX. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Binshtok, the Green Living editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so it's that time of year. Holiday shopping season is upon us, and everywhere you go, there's different green gift guide recommendations, every magazine, every TV show. But here at Sierra Club Radio, we're going to give you some unusual green gift ideas brought to you by Avital. And let's start by talking about this interesting feature that you did for the current issue of Sierra Magazine called Gifts That Keep On Living. I love
yeah.
that title.
Yeah, this was kind of born out of that gift guide fatigue that, you know, as an editor, I've experienced. And yeah, you just get bombarded with all different kinds of themes of gift guides. And I've done, you know, eco-themed gift guides before, but I wanted to do something a little bit different this year. And I thought and thought about it. And I just thought what fulfills me, and what fulfills me is to nurture a living thing often. Usually I get the most pleasure out of that than just having, you know, something made of plastic or cloth or something that's already dead or never was living. So I came up with this idea of doing a gift guide of things that are alive. And we called it Gifts That Keep On Living. And the little subtitle of the piece was, the problem with most holiday presents is that they're just so lifeless, and these aren't. So
So what does this mean? I mean, you can't just give someone a puppy. I mean, you could,
but a lot
of people are not going to want to be surprised with a gift that requires hours of work and nurturing without
Absolutely.
Knowing about it.
Yeah, and I took that into consideration. I actually thought of writing a little disclaimer, but, you know, these gifts that I ended up choosing are relatively maintenance-free, actually. But you still get that feeling of having something alive. And
okay, so let's get into the examples. What do you recommend?
So I think my favorite one of this is called an Ecosphere Pod. And it looks like a little aquarium, but it's actually closed on the top. It's shaped like, you know, like a big egg, basically. And in it are these little red shrimp and a couple of other things, but mainly the shrimp are the things that you'll perceive as alive. But there's also some algae that you don't see. And,
okay, wait. Now our listeners cannot see the picture.
Yeah, I'm trying to paint.
So I don't want them to picture like a fish bowl with shrimp in it, right? Because that would not be the gift you'd give.
Yeah.
This is actually, if the listeners could see this photo, it's beautiful. It's like an artfully arranged, kind of like what a terrarium would be, but it has like these beautiful branches and these little swimming tiny, tiny shrimp, not the kind you would eat.
Exactly. Thank you. That was a much better description than I was doing. And what I wrote about it was, think of it as Sea Monkey's more sophisticated cousin. So, but the crazy thing about it is that it's closed at the top. So, and you know, Sea Monkeys, you have to open the top and put food in. Same thing with fish bowls. But for this, you really just have to give it a little bit of natural light. And that's it. It's a totally enclosed ecosystem. It has all it needs in there. It's pretty magical. It's actually based on a concept that was developed for NASA. I adopted this one after the photo shoot. It's sitting on my desk, and I can't tell you like how much it improves my daily work. It's just
an ecosystem on your office desk.
Yeah, exactly. So that's
and a great conversation starter.
Exactly. Oh, people talk to me about it all the time, and it comes in different sizes. They range from about $60 to $150. So not super cheap, but a really good unique gift for someone who appreciates that kind of thing.
And what's the website?
Oh, yeah, it's you can get it at the product is called Ecosphere Pod, but the best website on which to get it is called windandweather.com.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, what else?
So I found this great mushroom kit. It's called a mushroom garden. It's from a company called Back to the Roots. These are two really young guys from UC Berkeley who started this company while they were still in college. And the soil is made of recycled coffee grounds. And the company's actually on track to save 1 million pounds of coffee waste from landfills this year. So that just that alone will make you feel good.
And so to clarify, this is to grow mushrooms that you can actually cook with?
Yes, absolutely. You can. It comes in a cardboard box, which acts as the vase. And then just within 10 days of opening it, you get about 1.5 pounds of pearl oyster mushrooms, which are actually gourmet mushrooms that would be expensive to buy elsewhere. And they'll keep growing, too.
It seems like that could be fun for kids, too.
Oh, yeah. I've got another couple of really great options for kids in this guide, too. One of them is...
Well, I'm not suggesting giving the kids a grow-your-own mushroom kit, because I think most kids would probably be... they'd rather have the train set or whatever.
Yeah, it depends
but I
on the
think
age.
It's for the whole family. I mean, I think it seems like an interesting and unusual way to kind of bring nature right into your kitchen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to go into this other product this one is really for kids. It's called the Live Butterfly Garden from a company called Insect Lore.
Ooh.
Yeah, and so you order. This is like the best reviewed product on Amazon that I've really ever seen. There are these parents that are like, I got this for my kid. Now he wants to be. Now he's so passionate about becoming a biologist, and that's mm-hmm. what he wants to be when he grow up. So it's just this little pop up habitat. Comes with 3 caterpillar. Comes with a little bit of enclosed food. You give them the food, and they'll get into their cocoon. And when they're starting to hatch, you just take them and release the butterflies with your kids outside. So it's just this amazing process of watching nature's miracle of metamorphosis with your kids.
And that sounds great.
What could be a better gift than
where
that?
Where do people find that?
So that's insectlore.com is the company's official website, although it's really big on Amazon, too.
Okay, so we have time for one more gift. What else do you recommend in this gifts that keep on living category?
Yeah, so I was trying to think about fashion, too, because a lot of people like giving little fashion doodads. And I was like, where do I look for this? And Etsy is always a really great source for that kind of stuff.
I think some of our listeners might not know Etsy.
Oh,
so what
yeah.
is it?
So Etsy is a communal, it's basically like a huge craft fair that's all on this one website. So all these indie, handmade craft artisan people sell all their amazingly creative things on Etsy. It's ETSY.com.
And the stuff there is beautiful, high quality,
by the way. Yeah, most of it is absolutely beautiful and unique. A lot of it is really one of a kind. But so I found this craftsperson on Etsy. Her username on that website is My Dog and I, all one word, My Dog and I. And she makes this this little ring. It's made of half an acorn, a tiny little bit of soil, and a little bit of moss that ends up looking like grass. And it's a ring that you wear on your finger, and it's actually living moss in a little acorn on your finger, which is it's really great. A lot of this stuff you kind of have to see a photo of to really understand how great it is, but it's just so creative, and it's, again, another just real conversation piece. And all you have to do is sprinkle it with a little bit of water every day and make sure it gets a little bit of natural light, which is also a good reminder for you to get a little bit of natural light.
Mm-hmm.
And that same craftsperson also makes these cute little necklaces. The chain is a recycled antique chain, and she has these tiny little glass bottles, and inside is some living moss. I think it's lichen. And it comes in different colors.
It looks like a little treasure in a bottle.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful, and it's something I'd never seen anywhere before. And it's alive. It's alive inside this little bottle. And again, it just needs a little bit of light to perpetuate itself. And it's just something very different.
Well, thanks for sharing all of these really unusual. These are definitely unusual gift ideas and definitely very green ideas for people. So I hope our listeners will check it out. And if you want to see the photos of all of these products together in one place, you can check out the current issue of Sierra Magazine or look online at sierramagazine.com. And you can look for the Green Life section and see all of these online.
Thanks, Harley.
You've been listening to Avital Binchtok, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine. We're here now with Chris Payne, the filmmaker of a new film called Revenge of the Electric Car. Welcome.
Thanks, Roy.
You know, Chris, I don't know if you remember this, but we had you on our show for the very first episode ever of Sierra Club Radio a couple of years ago, almost 5 years ago
well,
now.
I do remember. It's great to be back. I'm glad this show's been going on so long.
When we had you on the show last time, it was about your previous film, which was widely acclaimed, called Who Killed the Electric Car? And wondering if you can tell us about the kind of progression from that film to this follow-up film called Revenge of the Electric Car.
Well, just when you thought the electric car was going to be gone for quite a while, and when I say we, I mean, I think me, the industry began to turn around on this. And we began getting emails from people working inside the company saying, hey, you know what, I don't think the electric car is going to be gone for as long as we think. And sure enough, program started in many car companies around the world, and we decided, well, it's time to start making a new film.
And so what does this new film focus on?
The new film is really about people trying to change the system from inside, and we kind of tracked four archetypal characters that kind of represent different parts of corporations, and not the monolithic corporations that can create a lot of problems if they have poor leadership, but the way that individual business units can transform what a company is doing for whatever their reason. And so I like to think of it, sometimes you need to sink the Spanish galleons, and sometimes you need to get climb aboard and try to steer them in a better direction. And this film is definitely of the second kind.
What does the film show us about the electric car, where it's going, and what it's going to take to transform our culture into an electric car one?
What it really portrays is a kind of momentum, and shows the difficulty of bringing something like this to a mass market. It's really, really tough. And this is before we even get into all the arguments about, you know, whether electric cars are good and why they are really are a better solution just as cars, in addition to their environmental benefits and their benefits in terms of oil use in the country. We said, let's let the issues sit on the side and make a movie purely about the kinds of people it takes to bring innovation to the masses.
What does that innovation look like?
Well, in the case of our film, we tracked four different plug-in cars. We tracked Nissan's Leaf from its beginnings in Japan and the $6 billion that Nissan, under the leadership of this guy, Carlos Ghosn, who runs Renault and Nissan, they're producing a 80 to 100-mile pure electric vehicle to leapfrog Toyota in terms of what a vehicle can be. That was number one. Number two is we tracked General Motors, who said, no, the public's not ready for a pure electric car. Let's have an electric car that after 40 miles, gasoline is there so people can go on really long trips, and it takes that whole worry out of the equation. Then we covered Tesla Motors, the founding of the company in 3 or 4 years ago, and their evolution to a company that's making a lower-cost, high-end car that is a sedan that goes up to 200 miles. And finally, my next-door neighbor, who's a car converter that converts old Porsches into electric.
So what have some of the reactions been like to the film so far?
Oh, well, all kinds of reactions. I think people are surprised that this is happening. You know, in the same way that our first film, people were surprised that electric cars even existed, on this film, I think people are amazed that this kind of change is happening on such an industrial level. And I just hope that it's inspiring. You know, obviously cars aren't the answer to all of our problems, but if we can get our automobiles to start working off renewable energy, and that's what electricity can be, it can be renewable. And already, of course, the United States is less than 50% coal. So it's a turn in the right direction from an environmental perspective. But I think this sets a really nice horizon for what transportation can be.
So what were some of your favorite parts of the film?
In terms of making the film or
making the film, finding the stories? Yeah, I mean, just, you know, I think the process of making a film is really exciting and has so many different layers. And the filmmaker always has a unique perspective on you know, what were the most unusual and interesting parts of that process.
I'm really attracted to character, strong character, and I like the way each person's story unfolded over the 3 years that we filmed them. You know, our deal with the car companies is that we could get access, and by the way, we got turned down by a ton of car companies, but we could get access if we wouldn't show any footage until 2011. And so we had 3 years to sort of watch these very, you know, charismatic personalities go through their ups and considerable downs, as including, you know, bankruptcy at General Motors and Tesla completely ran out of money, and my friend's house had a huge disaster happen. And you can see people under a lot of stress and how they handle it. And so I guess from a personal perspective, that was the most interesting thing for me.
What message do you want viewers to take away from your film?
I want audiences to take away a sense of hope and a sense of being a part of the solution and part of the momentum into the future. I think we all got a little bit bombarded with documentaries that, you know, paint some portraits of how tough our situation is around the world, especially on an environmental level. And this is a rare moment where I think people can have some satisfaction that they helped change things for the better. And it's a rare privilege to be able to have a note of hope in a time of bad news.
Where can people go to see the film or find out where it's playing?
Well, if you check revengeoftheelectriccar.com, of course, we have a website for the film, and on that we have all the screens. The film is opening in 50 cities and through the end of the year. And then if you miss in the theater, I'm sure there'll be screenings next year as we get ready for the next phase of the film. I'd just like to thank the Sierra Club for supporting the film. You know, they've brought so many people to screenings, and it's very nice to see the environmental movement agreeing that, in spite of the obstacles around electricity, that the electric cars is a good thing for us.
Well, it's been great having you on the show today. You've been listening to Chris Payne, filmmaker of a new film called Revenge of the Electric Car.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Hello, Bill Nye, the planetary guy here. I'd like to thank you for listening to Plan Rad, Planetary Radio. This is how we get everybody in the world to participate in space exploration. You know, the Planetary Society has tens of thousands of members. We petition Congress. We participate in space conferences all over the world because we want to bring out the best in people. And that's what space exploration does. It just changes the way we think about our place in space. And by listening to Plan Rad, you're part of the community. So if you get time, please check out our website, planetary.org, and think about supporting us, because we are working together to change the world. It's an exciting time in space exploration, and I'd very much like it if you were an active participant. Thanks again for listening. I gotta fly. Bill Nye, the planetary guy.
Deva Sobel and her book about the man who revolutionized the heavens, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Copernicus did not publish On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres until just before his death. Now, there is a fascinating and beautiful book about this man and how he changed our view of the cosmos. Its author, Deva Sobel, will join us. We won't hear from Emily Lakdawalla this week. She is attending the annual meeting of the American Geophysical Union, and she'll provide an extended report on that gathering next week, which means we can go directly to Bill Nye, the planetary guy. Bill, we got good news and bad news. I guess we'll start with the bad news, which is one spacecraft which it's looking more and more like it is not going to be headed to Mars' moon Phobos.
That's right. The Phobos Grunt mission, the Russian word for soil is grunt, was going to go to the Martian moon Phobos, scoop up a little Phobos, and come back in 3 years. Well, you start on such a journey by getting an Earth orbit, parking orbit, and then firing a big thruster and shooting off. Well, it looks like that thruster isn't going to fire, and the European Space Agency has given up. They've been helping out, tracking this thing. It goes across the sky very fast. You have very little time to send it a signal, and very hard to get a photograph, but there are some photographs, and you can see them on the Planetary Society website on Emily Lakdawalla's blog. I think the entry is December 2nd. Yeah, you'll find her reporting on that, and it's, of course, as always, her reportage is very good. And the thing is stuck, and it's heartbreaking. You know, the Planetary Society's invested in this. We have our living interplanetary flight experiment bolted on, and it looks like the whole thing is going to burn up in the Earth's atmosphere around middle of January. But check out the pictures. It really is striking that these guys were able to get these shots. But it is heartbreaking. You know, the Russians sent the first missions to Venus successfully. They sent the first missions to the Earth's moon. If you want to go to the space station, you take a Soyuz rocket. But they've tried 23 times to go to Mars, and they haven't made it. It's heartbreaking. Meanwhile, Matt, Curiosity, MSL, the Mars Science Laboratory, is right on track. It launched perfectly. It's right on its course. It's going to land on Mars Sunday night, August 5th, or Monday morning, August 6th, depending on your time zone. And come to Planet Fest. It's going
to
be wild.
A little early to invite people, I suppose, but we are going to be celebrating in Pasadena on those 2 days, August 4th and 5th.
And we are negotiating to celebrate in several other science centers and museums, planetariums around the world, because this really is another global effort. People all over the world got together to build this exquisite spacecraft that will make the next discoveries on Mars, and who knows where that will lead us. My dream, as always, is to find evidence or a way to find evidence of life on that other world. It's an exciting time in planetary exploration. It really is.
Bill, thank you so much. It's always good to talk to you, and we'll do it again next week.
Thank you, Matt.
Bill Nye is the executive director of the Planetary Society, the science and planetary guy. Up next, another conversation with Dava Sobel. Her newest book is about the man who put our planet in its proper place in the solar system and the cosmos. That, of course, is Copernicus, and the book is A More Perfect Heaven. We'll pick that up in just a few moments. Did you get hooked on Dava Sobel's work with Longitude, or was it Galileo's daughter? Regardless, you can now get your hands on the latest work by this historian who so beautifully tells us about people who profoundly changed the course of knowledge and exploration. Her latest is A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. It has made me realize that this 15th and 16th century Polish physician and church official deserves more admiration and gratitude than I've felt till now. Yet there are key portions of his life about which we know very little. As you'll hear, Dava has found a unique and very entertaining way to deal with these episodes. Dava, it's a delight to get you back on Planetary Radio. It's been much too long, but then it's been a long time since we talked about your last book, The Planets. Thanks for returning to the show.
Hi, Matt. I'm happy to be back.
Just how revolutionary was it, pun intended, that this fellow Copernicus decided that the Earth was not at the center of the universe? I mean, after all, this was at the time of Columbus, and a lot of people knew or believed that the world was round.
People have known the Earth is round since ancient times. The idea that we needed Columbus to sail west to get east to teach us that the planet is actually round is a fiction introduced by Washington Irving in the 19th century. Hmm. But the question of the Earth's motion is a whole other agenda. And I think today we know it so well that it is hard to imagine a time when people could not accept it. And yet we know those things only because we've been told. If you had to figure out the Earth's motion by yourself, it would be very hard to do. There is nothing that gives you a sense of the motion.
It's counterintuitive.
It's not only counterintuitive, it goes against received wisdom. And one of the things Copernicus worried about most during the close to 30 years that he kept the idea from publication was the worry that people would use passages from the Bible twisted to their purposes to discredit him. He worried a lot about ridicule, because it just seemed ridiculous for the Earth to be rotating and revolving as fast as it would have to go to account for the heavenly motion.
This was not a fire-breathing revolutionary. In fact, had it not been for this, you might have called him a Copernicus groupie who showed up, you might have written your book about an effective bureaucrat who instituted currency reform.
Exactly. Copernicus did lots of things, but seems to have been an obedient type of person. He belonged to a church community, was a canon, meaning an administrator, of the Catholic Church in the northern regions of Poland. He grew up in a place that was German-speaking, so his native language was German, but he was a subject of the King of Poland. He did so many other things. He was personal physician to the bishop. He administered the church lands. He set up a system of currency reform that the Senate and the King actually adopted. On the side, he had this extraordinary idea and devoted all his free time to the pursuit of his astronomy, something he got interested in probably as a college student. That's the first evidence of his interest in astronomy comes from the books he collected when he was a student. If he had not come up with this, I would not have written a book about him. The idea, which had preceded him by many centuries, by Aristarchus in the 3rd century BC, although unfortunately Aristarchus's book on his sun-centered plan disappeared in antiquity. So there is no remnant of it. There's only a summary of the idea by Archimedes in a book that was translated and published the year after Copernicus died. So although Copernicus knew of other astronomical work by Aristarchus, he never knew about that piece of Aristarchus's work. It would have been a great solace to him to have known that, and he certainly would have mentioned it because he felt he needed all the support he could muster.
With all the threats he faced, just perceived and the real ones possibly, you know, what drove him? Why did he push forward with this research?
I think he felt from early on that he had actually discovered the true structure of the cosmos, something that was deemed impossible in his day. The only way you could know such things would be to have them divinely revealed to you. But something about his work perhaps convinced him that he had experienced a divine revelation. When he had the idea of putting the sun at the center and the earth in motion, he had a reason for the varying speeds of the planets. Before that, it didn't really make sense. And the order of the planets was not known definitely. So by putting the sun at the center and the earth in motion, now all the planets lined up in order of their speed. Although he knew nothing of gravity, he must have seen that as the correct arrangement, even though he couldn't prove it.
So he comes up with this truly revolutionary concept, and then he's prepared to just sit on it. I mean, how did word even get out to this fellow Reticus, who so much of this story revolves around? I keep using that word.
It's hard to avoid it. Well, even before Reticus was born, Copernicus wrote a very brief summary of his ideas. He alerted a few fellow mathematicians to his idea. And because this type of letter served as a scientific journal in that day, people had the freedom to copy letters they received and send them to other potentially interested parties. Over the years, Copernicus was working, doing the mathematics, making observations, writing his book. The idea was slowly making its way among astronomers. When Reticus, the young German genius, who by 22 was already a professor at Martin Luther's University in Wittenberg, he was traveling around Germany seeking out established astronomers to learn more. And in Nuremberg, he was told about Copernicus. And he went to visit him. This was a long, difficult, dangerous journey, but he seems to have been highly motivated.
I mean, apparently he just shows up at Copernicus's door to somewhat to the distress of Copernicus.
Yes, well, we don't know how Copernicus reacted. This was the reason I wanted to write a play. Everyone knows that this meeting took place. There is ample documentation. For one thing, soon after Rheticus arrived, he wrote his own summary of Copernicus's theory and got it published as a way to show Copernicus that there would be a receptive audience. The world would not explode if he made a formal statement of his ideas. That document exists. Other letters exist from Rheticus to his colleagues back in Germany. The meeting was long and productive, but there is no record of what got said, how Rheticus was received, and the biggest question for me, how did they get around the fact that the bishop where Copernicus lived had grown so paranoid about the Protestant Reformation that he had banished all the Lutherans? And of course, Rheticus was Lutheran, but somehow Copernicus kept him there for 2 years.
Author Deva Sobel on her new book about Copernicus, A More Perfect Heaven. Much more in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
I'm Sally Ride. After becoming the first American woman in space, I dedicated myself to supporting space exploration and the education and inspiration of our youth. That's why I formed Sally Ride Science, and that's why I support the Planetary Society. The Society works with space agencies around the world and gets people directly involved with real space missions. It takes a lot to create exciting projects like the first solar sail, informative publications like an award-winning magazine, and many other outreach efforts like this radio show. Help make space exploration and inspiration happen. Here's how you can join us.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. Deva Sobel has returned to our show with her new book about the man who revolutionized our view of the cosmos. In fact, that's nearly the book's subtitle. The new work by the author of Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and the Planets is A More Perfect Heaven. It follows the life of the revered and reverent astronomer Copernicus, who was as much a physician and bureaucrat as he was a stargazer. Deva had to face the problem other biographers have run into with Copernicus. There are key periods of his life about which we know next to nothing. So in the absence of background material, you interrupt your beautiful lyrical prose, quite typical of your past work, and we find this play, which I guess is how you wanted to express your speculation.
Yes, it's clearly labeled as drama fiction. It is an imagined narrative. To add to that, I've put a preface at the beginning of the book with a nod toward the famous anonymous preface in Copernicus's book that tells readers not to take it too seriously. But my preface says that this is a book, a carefully researched historical narrative with a play in the middle that imagines the missing parts.
This preface warning us not to take this too seriously, obviously people took it quite seriously, but it was not a book that was immediately rejected or banned by the church. In fact, I got the impression it was almost embraced by elements of the church.
Copernicus decided to dedicate the book to the Pope as a way of showing that he had no irreverent intentions. And the dedication letter is quite long and describes his fear of ridicule and his fear of what he called babblers who knew nothing of astronomy but would seize on some passage of the Bible to show that Copernicus's ideas were wrong. One imagines that he must have gotten permission to dedicate the book to the Pope. However, you can be certain the Pope never read it. He did turn it over to his theological advisors, who really didn't like it. and said negative things about it in print, but not in a way that had an effect. And the first astronomers who read it were convinced by the preface that the notion was merely a way of thinking about the motions. You shouldn't really put the sun at the center and set the Earth moving, but if you did that, you could calculate the planetary positions better than you had been able to before. 50 or 60 years went by. Kepler was ready to embrace the idea. Tycho was not.
That would be Tycho Brahe.
Yes, he could not absorb the Earth's motion or the great distance to the stars that the heliocentric design required. Tycho found that ridiculous, that the stars would have to be much too big, too far away, too big. It struck him as almost as ridiculous as the Earth's motion. So he rejected it. But Galileo was leaning toward Copernicus, called himself a secret Copernican in a letter to Kepler. But when Galileo made his first telescopic discoveries, then he became convinced that Copernicus was right. And he began endorsing him publicly, both in lectures and in writing. And Galileo's great crime was to communicate in Italian, because he was interested in reaching an audience of intelligent adults who had not had a university education and so could not read Latin. And that is why the church came down so hard on him. So in 1616, the Inquisition told Galileo to stop talking about these things and listed Copernicus's book on the index of prohibited books as suspended until corrected.
How long was it before the church finally decided that the reality of the cosmos could be accepted as part of church doctrine?
It took a long time. In Galileo's time, it was certainly not accepted. By the time Galileo died, that was 100 years after Copernicus's book. By the 18th century, the ban on teaching the Earth's motion was lifted. However, Galileo's book and Copernicus's book remained on the index till 1835.
Incredible. I mean, well into the period of Enlightenment, when we that really did shock me, by the way, that I just, maybe through inertia, it was left there.
Part of it was inertia, because certainly other people were already talking about the Earth's motion. And this aspect interests me so much, because what we consider today the real proof of the Earth's motion, things like the aberration of starlight, Foucault's pendulum, and the main proof, the discovery of parallax. One of the objections to Copernicus was, if the Earth is traveling all the way around the sun every year, then certainly the stars should look different from one point in the orbit to another. But they don't. And Copernicus's answer was, oh, well, that's because they're so far away, you can't see a difference. He was right about that. And it took till the 1860s to have telescopes powerful enough to detect a difference in the stellar position over the course of a year. By that time, people had already accepted it. So it wasn't as though the world was waiting for the absolute proof. By the time of Newton, when there was a complete schema for all of these ideas, they became accepted. Everything fit together too well. It made too much sense. So by the end of the 17th century, scientists really had embraced it.
Your book closes in the current day with maybe the final effort to rehabilitate, that's a terrible word to use, to put Copernicus in the position of respect that he deserves, and the church was a full participant in this.
Copernicus was recently exhumed and his remains identified definitively, and then he was given a formal burial where the highest bishop of Poland presided. The church has embraced him. He never suffered any kind of condemnation. Even when his book was on the index, it wasn't really banned. It was suspended until corrected, which was a different category. Mm. And certainly in the time of Pope John Paul II, who was Polish and considered Copernicus a hero, he's definitely been okay in all circles. And scientists continue to admire and reward him. The most recent event being the naming of element number 112, copernicium. Just a salute from modern-day chemists and physicists.
If you would like to learn more about the Copernican Revolution and how it has changed our view, not just of the cosmos, but to a degree of ourselves, I can highly recommend A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos by our guest, Dava Sobel. You'll find it in all the usual places. It's published by Walker & Company. And Dava, I just want to thank you once again for being part of the radio show and bringing us this terrific exploration of one of the great figures of history.
Thank you, Matt. I always enjoy talking to you.
Dava Sobel is also the author, of course, of Longitude and Galileo's Daughter and The Planets, which was the last conversation we had with her on this show. I look forward to the next opportunity, even though it may be a few years, Dava.
I get slower and slower.
And better and better. We'll be right back for our weekly visit with Bruce Betts and a look at that night sky, which Copernicus made so much more impressive. Time once again for What's Up here at the end of this episode of Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is here. He's the director of projects for the Planetary Society, and I think he'll tell us what's up in the night sky, but we've got other fun stuff too.
Hello. I'm ready for fun stuff.
It's all fun. It's all good.
It's all big fun. Hey, let's get right into what's up in the sky because there's some cool stuff happening in the next couple weeks. December 10th, total lunar eclipse. Visible from many, many places, from all of Asia and Australia, most of Europe, Africa, and most of North America, including us. In the greatest eclipse, meaning when it is deepest in eclipse, is at 1432 Universal Time, 632 Pacific Standard Time for us in the morning. So the moon sets for us, being selfish, during eclipse. But good visibility and always cool to have a total lunar eclipse. We also have the traditional best meteor shower of the year, the Geminids, peaking on December 13th and 14th. But moonlight will be obscuring the faintest meteors this year.
Moonlight gets in your eyes.
Ow! That's why I wear sunglasses at night. We also have our friends, the planets up, Venus super bright, low in the west, and then turn your head around, look more towards the east or southeast, and you'll see super bright Jupiter, also Saturn and Mars in the pre-dawn. We move on to this week in space history. It was 1972 when we had the last Apollo land on the moon. Apollo 17 landed on the moon this week, 1972. We also had in 1990... Galileo made its first Earth flyby on the way to Jupiter. Kept coming back around. What do you think he did 2 years later exactly?
Came by home again.
Exactly. Its second Earth flyby on the way to Jupiter.
Forgot its lunch.
Exactly. Mom, just stick it out at geostationary orbit. I'll grab it on the way by. It's going to be a long trip. All right, we move on to random space. Fact.
What was that little head jerk thing? Trying not to blow out the microphone.
Yeah, you get so mad when I do that.
Do it one more time.
You want me to blow out the microphone?
No, just don't turn as far.
Random space fact.
Now that was good.
Oh, that was good. Okay.
We're going to make you a radio guy yet.
God. It'll only take another 25 years. The Saurus, although it sounds like some species on Star Trek, the Saurus, S-A-R-O-S, is a period of about 18 years and 11 days. Do you know why we care?
I don't even know what that word is. Go ahead.
Exactly. That's why it's a random space fact. That is how long it takes for the eclipse cycle to basically repeat. So one Saurus later, after an eclipse, whether solar or lunar, the Sun, Earth, and Moon return to approximately the same relative geometry, and a nearly identical eclipse will occur.
What, me, Saurus?
You, Saurus. Me, Jane. Wait, no. So with this lunar eclipse coming up, presumably one Saurus ago, there was another one, nearly identical. We go on to the trivia contest, and we asked you, who was the first Soviet or Russian to launch on a U.S. launch vehicle? How'd we do?
You know, I made a big deal about thinking, oh, I didn't know there'd been any. And then the first answer came in, the first correct answer, and I thought, well, of course, he figuratively slapped his forehead. It was, thank you.
Ow.
Do it again so we can hear it.
Oh, I love it.
You didn't actually need me to do it again, did you?
No, not really. Sergei Krikalev. Sergei Krikalev, of course. The guy who's been in space more than any other human being.
Exactly. And he first launched on a space shuttle in 1994.
We're going to give a Planetary Radio t-shirt to Caesar. It's either Caesar or Caesar Musitani in Manassas, Virginia. You've been there.
I have. I've been there multiple times. It's very Manassas.
We thank you, Caesar or Caesar. You've won for this week. Let's give other people a chance.
All right, here's a new trivia contest. Speaking of Saurus, how many SARs are there in a Saurus? I kid you not. The unit of SAR, S-A-R. How many of them are there in a Saurus, S-A-R-O-S? Go to planetary.org/radio. Find out how to enter.
Be sure to enter by Monday, December 12th at 2 p.m. Pacific time, or you will be Saurus.
That was brilliant. That's what that was. Oh, everybody go out there, look up in the night sky, and try to forget whatever you're most Saurus about. Thank you and good night.
I've already forgotten. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up.
I don't even know what we're talking about anymore.
Planetary Radio is made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the members of the Planetary Society, which is responsible for its content. Clear skies.
Ladies and gentlemen, gather around. I would love to share with you a story. Once upon a time in 19th century Germany, there was the book. Now, during this time, the book was the king of storytelling. It was venerable. It was ubiquitous. But it was a little bit boring. Because in its 400 years of existence, storytellers never evolved the book as a storytelling device. But then one author arrived, and he changed the game forever. His name was Lothar. Lothar Meggendorfer. Lothar Meggendorfer put his foot down, and he said, "Genug ist genug." He grabbed his pen. He snatched his scissors. This man refused to fold to the conventions of normalcy and just decided to fold. History would know Lothar Meggendorfer as, who else? The world's first true inventor of the children's pop-up book. Yes. For this delight and for this wonder, people rejoiced. They were happy because the story survived and that the world would keep on spinning. Lothar Meggendorfer wasn't the first to evolve the way a story was told, and he certainly wasn't the last. Whether storytellers realized it or not, they were channeling Meggendorfer's spirit when they moved opera to vaudeville, radio news to radio theater, film to film in motion, to film in sound, color, 3D, on VHS, and on DVD. There seemed to be no cure for this Meggendorferitis. And things got a lot more fun when the internet came around. Because not only could people broadcast their stories throughout the world, but they can do so using with what seemed to be an infinite amount of devices. For example, one company would tell a story of love through its very own search engine. One Taiwanese production studio would interpret American politics in 3D. And one man, would tell the stories of his father by using a platform called Twitter to communicate the excrement his father would gesticulate. And after all this, everyone paused. They took a step back. They realized that in 6,000 years of storytelling, they've gone from depicting hunting on cave walls to depicting Shakespeare on Facebook walls. And this was a cause for celebration. The art of storytelling has remained unchanged. And for the most part, the stories are recycled. But the way that humans tell the stories has always evolved with pure, consistent novelty. And they remembered a man, one amazing German, every time a new storytelling device popped up next. And for that,